classes that I gave on Kabbalah. And I was originally going to give two, but then the question came up with the copper serpent. So we went into that, which I felt was extremely important. I'm glad that the audience asked that question. That's a very good question. It's important to understand that episode in the Torah clearly. But now I just like to present the concluding chapter of the idea of Kabbalah that we find around so much today. I mean, it's ubiquitous. It's all over. It's wherever you go around the world. This is the in thing. Now, what I want to mention is
Rabbi.
Yes.
May I make a suggestion, because we have been off a couple of weeks on this. Distinguish between authentic Kabbalah that you've already done, but I think it needs to be emphasized again, authentic Kabbalah in comparison to this.
I'm going to try to work my way into that, okay?
Okay.
What I want to do is, before, I want to give you an example of unauthentic Kabbalah, okay? So, today's Kabbalah. Today's Kabbalah, and again, I want to make this point clear, today's Kabbalah, what people call Kabbalah today, has nothing whatsoever to do with real Kabbalah. And we've shown that from there is no one that will deny that the head of the Kabbalists is Nachmanides, okay? And I mentioned to you that Nachmanides himself gives a very clear warning that against anyone that thinks that they know Kabbalah, who does not have a teacher that goes back all the way, one teacher from another, all the way to Moses. If you don't have that, then you can forget about it. As a matter of fact, he says, if you try to understand Kabbalah without that, you will go away from God, and you'll wind up losing your place in the world to come, and the worst possible catastrophe can happen to such a person. He quotes from the prophets and from the scholars, the rabbis, where they say on innumerable occasions that a person should not attempt to understand things that he's not capable of understanding. And that lure is the most dangerous thing. It's something which is very alluring, because everyone thinks that they're ready to study the most profound ideas when they can't understand the most simple ones. But this is what today's Kabbalah basically is. Now, I have in my hand before me an article. I don't want to quote the name of the author, but it's someone who's a PhD, he's an educated person, and he spoke about the serpents. So it's called Serpents, Angels, and Augury. Now, I'm just going to, he has this whole thing worked out, this mystical kind of, I don't know what he calls it, they usually find some kind of scientific name for it. And it's called, he calls it general projective principles. The people are very quick in our society to coin names. But I'm just going to read to you what he says at the end of his article. He says that if we understand, as now we must, the word seraphim to be another expression of the general projective principle, the phrase, then one of the seraphim flew to me, which is a phrase from Isaiah, he says, takes on a new, penetrating, and profound meaning. And he says, we feel, end quotes, the sense of it deep within us, and the experience of the feeling is transcendent. Whenever you see something like that, you know immediately that this is the mark of nonsense, and basically it's rooted in idolatry. Of course, he senses this too, and he says, I cannot conclude without saying a few words about the dangers inherent in the symbols and geometries which model the ideas expressed in these and other sacred texts. We must never forget that the models are merely tools to help us understand fundamental truths about ourselves and the world in which we live. They must never be misused or become idolatrous. Okay? The reason why he says this is, of course, because he is on an idolatrous path and he does sense it. Okay, and you'll notice the contradiction here. He says, helps us understand fundamental truths about ourselves and the world in which we live. Yet in the previous sentence, he says, we feel the sense of it deep within us, which has nothing to do with understanding. It's just a feeling, okay, an emotion. Now, in the end, he says that this all too clear with regards to the brazen serpent of Moses. Okay, actually, it wasn't brass. It was copper or bronze. Brass was a much later development. But at any rate, he says, not only did it heal the people in the desert, but it continued to be so efficacious in healing that by the time of King Hezekiah, people had forgotten the meaning of sickness and the true source of all healing, God, and the brazen serpent had become an object of worship. In Kings 2, 18:4, we read that King Hezekiah broke in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made, for until that time the children of Israel did burn incense to it. Okay, now here he is gone already into the idolatry, where he maintains that this brazen serpent healed all the people and nobody was sick from the time of Moses, which is an absolutely false notion. It's absolutely false that no one was sick because everybody had this serpent, which really cured them. Now this is precisely the opposite of what the Torah teaches us. Okay, what the prophets teach us. Now, I can't overemphasize the importance of what Maimonides states, and that is extremely important in order to understand Torah, to have a knowledge of the mystical and the idolatrous, because that's exactly what the Torah says. The Torah says several times that the other nations are the worshippers of idolatry, and you are not to be like them, and you're not to learn to practice their practices. As a matter of fact, you're not even allowed to learn what they do if you're doing it out of emotional curiosity. You're allowed to learn what they do, what they practice, if it is in order to understand it, in order to see the folly of their ways. And as you know, it was incumbent upon the Sanhedrin to know to have this kind of a knowledge. But what he is saying is true idolatry. To maintain that this serpent was actually a healing force, that is idolatry. And what I will show you is that the prophet says exactly the opposite. But first of all, I want you to know that those systems which operate that way, in other words, operate in the manner that they believe in this healing type of idea, that objects heal, these mystical healing powers. Those systems that believe in that type of a thing, it's a certain frame of mind. That's why I say you really have to study these areas in order to grasp what they are. Many times in our society, I mean, people just aren't aware of the nature and the way these people think, their mindset. It's a different kind of a mindset. Now, I can tell you this. In that mindset, every time an object is believed to have a curative power, this object is always endowed with the greatest importance. Nobody would ever destroy it. That would be the worst thing that you could do. Okay? So, you understand very well that had the Torah system been based on such an idea, which, of course, we never find overtly in the Torah, had the Torah system been based on such an idea, Hezekiah never would have been able to destroy it. It would be like the most horrible thing. Well, if this is the healing power, this thing has healing power from God, and it was through Moses, how could they destroy such a thing? That's precisely why Hezekiah destroyed it, because he wanted to show that it has no power whatsoever, and that the event that took place with Moses was, as the Talmud states, based completely on the fact that it was used as a tool in order to get the people to repent, which I spoke about at length last time, and I showed you, if you analyze the verses in the Torah itself, you'll see that that is the only correct interpretation. But if you take a look at what the in Kings 2, 2 Kings 18, okay, 2 Kings 18, 4, okay? Now, it says, and I mentioned this last time as well, it says that he called the thing. He called it a name. It doesn't just say he destroyed it. That's all this fellow quotes in his articles, is just he destroyed it. He forgot to mention the very important part of the verse, the last part of the verse, which says that he called it copper, okay? He gave it a name, copper, piece of copper, okay? Now, I will give you the scholarly commentaries, the official commentaries of the prophets, and they are Rashi, okay, I'm sure you're familiar with his name, Radak, all right, Ralbag, which you might not be as familiar with, Metsudos is another one. All four are on the page, right on the page of Kings, and they all explain what is meant by the fact that Hezekiah called this serpent, the snake, he called it Nehushtan. And I told you, I explained to you last time, but they all say, every one of them says the exact same thing, that what he said was, how can you worship this thing? This thing has no power, it's just a piece of copper. That's all it is. That's what the prophet is teaching you when he tells you that not only did Hezekiah destroy it, because the prophet knows how deep these mystical emotions run, and the prophet realized that Hezekiah knew that if he would just destroy it, that wouldn't be enough, because somebody's going to say, well, yeah, it had real powers. Maybe that's why he destroyed it. Even though I told you, according to, if you study the mindset of people that believe in these things, they would never destroy it. Okay? But Hezekiah was even more careful than that, and the prophet was very careful to record what Hezekiah did, namely that he called it this name, copper. And I told you exactly what that means. The copper is what it was made out of, a substance. People are enthralled by something, not because of the substance, but because of the shape and the form. Okay? It had the shape of a serpent. The shape is what makes the idolater attribute something to the idol, not the substance. If it would just melt down, as a matter of fact, you find in the Bible that when the idols melted, to show that they were worthless, it means that they just become lumps of substance. Nobody worships a lump of copper or a lump of silver or a lump of gold. So what Hezekiah said, expressed, and what the prophet was careful to record was that he called it a substance. It's nothing more than a lump. This shape is meaningless. It has no power. You're worshiping the thing because of its shape, but it's really nothing more than a lump of copper. And that's why he made that clear in order to show the people that it has no power and never had any power. Okay? But again, this is the battle that the Torah always has, and that is to remove from man the primitive, the attraction to the primitive, and that's precisely why Hezekiah had to destroy it. Now, this individual who is what I would call a modern day so-called quotes Kabbalist, okay, fell right into the idolatrous trap, which Hezekiah was trying to remove the people from, and which the prophet carefully recorded in order to make sure there shouldn't be any error. Okay? But here this man just fell right exactly, precisely into the deepest level of idolatrous thought, which is basically the belief that this thing had a power. Okay. I wanted to make that clear. Now, I would just like to mention a few more things concerning the Kabbalah, which I think you should know. And the fact that people, you see, you have to understand something, that there were true Kabbalists, and Nachmanides was one of them. He had a student, Rashbah, who also received the knowledge from him. But I want to make this clear to you, that Rashbah in his writings, he's the genuine disciple of Nachmanides and a foremost Talmudic scholar. When he speaks about the knowledge of God, he speaks about Kabbalistic ideas, he speaks about the fact that they are very abstract and abstruse, and they're not simple to comprehend, and he says only one or two people can comprehend them. But he speaks of them in the way of comprehension, which means it's something that the mind has to grasp. No one ever spoke of different modes of cognition, which all these primitive people talk about, or which I just quoted to you before. As this fellow says, we feel the sense of it deep within us, and the experience of the feeling is transcendent. This kind of stuff is not Torah, and it's not from our scholars. This is this is today's primitive mysticism. And I want to mention to you that a person can be a PhD and still be very primitive. Man has, Sigmund Freud was correct when he said man has the ability to dichotomize his mind. A person can be use his intellect in one area selectively and not in another area. In another area, he could remain as primitive as could be. As you see, there are noted personalities who follow astrology. Now, we know today astrology is nonsense because astrology is based on a certain configuration of the universe. The constellations were thought to be the ends of the universe, and they were thought to exercise and exert power on the Earth. But today it's nonsense because we know that the universe is billions of times greater than the constellations. The constellations are nothing. They're no different than billions and billions of other stars out there. The only thing is that they're visible to us, and if you have a good imagination, you can make pictures up there out of them. But they're nothing in terms of astronomically. We know today science has advanced to the point where it's stupid and ridiculous to believe that those specific stars that you see and that you draw pictures out of have any kind of influence. If you want to say that, you should say that about billions and billions and billions of other stars in the universe. Okay? So the mere structure of today's universe disproves at a glance the whole basis of astrology. But nevertheless, people do believe and guide their lives. Intelligent people, so-called intelligent people, guide their lives by these things. And that is, as I mentioned before, something which Sigmund Freud made quite clear, and that is that a person's mind could be dichotomized. He could be brilliant in one area and yet stupid in another. But Torah does not tolerate such a thing. Torah demands that the entire person use be intelligent, and that a person use their intelligence. The person uses intelligence in every area. Okay, that really is the mark of the perfected individual. All right, there were people who were brilliant in math, and yet in other areas acted, remarkably ridiculous. There's a book called Men of Mathematics by E.T. Bell. I mean, he has the biographies of various mathematicians, and some of them you'd be astounded at the way they lived. But that's because, again, that a person can be a genius in math and yet be an idiot with regard to other areas of life. This is not what the Torah demands of a person. The Torah demands that a person use wisdom, as the Torah says, as the prophet says about King David. The prophet says, and David was in all his ways wise, and God was with him. That means that he applied his wisdom in every manifestation of his personality. That is the mark of the perfected individual. Now you see the attraction to the mystical is very, very strong. Very, very strong. It is definitely stronger among, in general. I'm not saying in particular. But in general, it is strongest among the ignorant. I mean, you won't find too many physicists that believe in the primitive, although you do find a few. I mean, as I said before, a person can dichotomize his mind. I mean, there's no question about it. But in general, if we look at in general, we'll find that the less educated a person is, the more they are prone to these kind of primitive beliefs. I mean, they're not killing witches in Salem anymore today. They were 300 years ago. And there's no doubt that progress and science has much to do with the removal of the primitive, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing, because the purpose of the Torah is to show that the whole universe works according to God's wisdom and nothing else. So progress is a wonderful thing, and there is no doubt about it. The fact that we have had progress has removed a lot of primitive notions, I should say, from people's lives. I mean, I don't think there are too many people that think that the thunderstorm is a result of the gods getting angry in the sky anymore. Okay? So science is a wonderful thing in the eyes of Torah because it shows that the world works according to only one thing, and that is wisdom and knowledge. And there is nothing else that you could use in order to understand the world, to understand God's universe, and anything else that you use is just your own primitive emotions. But the primitive generally, as I say, strikes as most attractive to the uneducated. Or the educated who, again, compartmentalize their lives. Okay. Now, there is a restriction, a halachic restriction against studying Kabbalah, against the study of Kabbalah till a person reaches the age of 40. What it means by 40 is 40 years of study of Torah. And that means the person must be extremely proficient in the knowledge of Torah. The reason now, if Kabbalah is what they are telling, or they are telling people it is out there, those people have no proficiency whatsoever in Talmud. And the reason why the halacha has this stipulation is very simple, because the halacha demands that a person perfect their knowledge first of Torah, of the revealed Torah, which is that which we know, which is the halachic, that is the scientific halachic aspect of Torah. If a person masters that and becomes a scholar in understanding the in-depth psychology and philosophy and halacha of Torah, then they can go into the world of metaphysics, beyond the world beyond, because they are equipped to understand it in a rational way with their intelligence and with their minds, and they won't be duped into following their emotions, because 40 years, a lifetime of work in the area of rational thought, has an effect on a person. And that's precisely why the halacha prohibited any kind of involvement in philosophy until a person is totally perfected in the rational system of Torah. Today's people, you see, there are many statements of the rabbis, and we know that the statements all agree that the statements of the rabbis, when it comes to agada, are really couched in metaphor, and they're not to be understood literally. The ignorant person will, however, upon seeing some of the metaphors, be attracted to the metaphor itself, which is just a shell, and will start believing that these literally what the metaphor states, which the rabbis actually use the metaphor precisely in order to show precisely that it cannot be what it overtly means.
Rabbi?
You should look for a hidden meaning there, yes.
All right. Question.
Okay.
In halakha, would there or could there be an exception to a person being 40 before he studies Kabbalah, perhaps a great student or something? Do you have any examples of that in
yes.
antiquity?
You have, you see, the halacha, the halacha, which is a general restriction, which was accepted in the past several generations by the scholars of the generation. It is not a halacha. It is not the kind of halacha that is Sinaitic. In other words, there is no halacha that Moses received at Sinai that's specified any age. Okay. The reason why the scholars several hundred years ago mentioned, they said that no one should do it before the age of 40, was simply because they noticed that in their situation, anyone that has less scholarship is going to fail and is going to fall into idolatry. And many of the authentic Kabbalists warned against the study of Kabbalah, not only Nachmanides, others as well, because as a matter of fact, they cited, they would say that a person that cannot even understand a piece of Chumash, the Bible, and Rashi, on his own is studying Kabbalistic ideas, and they have to become idolatrous, because there is no way without the capacity, the intellectual capacity, that they should escape the attraction of the mystical. That's all they are, is just primitive emotion. There's no developed intellect there. But no, it is not a halacha of 40. That's a good question you raise. It's not a halacha of 40. There is no number 40 that was given down at Sinai. It was an agreement among the scholars of the time, because they saw what was happening, very similar to what's happening today. And they saw the danger, and therefore they said that no one before the age of 40. The reason why they chose the age of 40 is because the Talmud does say that it takes, that if a person studies Talmud for 40 years, after 40 years of the study of Talmud, under an astute teacher, that a person reaches a deeper level of understanding. If the person progresses normally, the depth keeps on increasing, And after a period of approximately 40 years, the Talmud does derive this is Sinaitic, that there is a under normal circumstances, if a person has a good mind and applies themselves, after a 40-year period, you can understand the person's understanding reaches its highest level, its depth. In other words, its deepest level. You see, there are two types of learning. There's acquisitive learning. The more you learn, of course, the more knowledge you always have. That doesn't matter if after 40 or before 40. But there is a certain qualitative depth of knowledge that a person reaches after a certain amount of time in study, and after that, it becomes they don't really get tremendously deeper. They just increase the span and the scope of their knowledge. So knowledge has two aspects to it. There's scope and knowledge, and there's depth. But depth is a person keeps on reaching keeps on getting deeper and deeper as they progress until approximately, it's an approximation, but it is a valid approximation until approximately 40 years of study. But after that time, the mind doesn't go any deeper. It'll increase in scope, but not in depth. Doesn't mean at all, but perceptibly, that the person will not continue to generally speaking will not continue to go deeper. They reach a certain plateau in depth, and then they increase in scope. This is true in Torah, and again, it's not something which is necessarily true of every single human being. I know Rabbi Soloveitchik one time mentioned that his grandfather was an exception. He said his grandfather kept on and his grandfather was one of the foremost geniuses of Talmud, and he said as his grandfather kept on getting older, he kept on getting deeper, and as a matter of fact, he said that people did not like a lot of the, weren't too thrilled with a lot of the ideas that he had in his later years, because they were very abstract and people just couldn't catch them, couldn't grasp them fully. They enjoyed more the things that he said when he was younger because they were able to grasp them more fully and he wasn't as abstract. He wasn't as deep. But Rabbi Soloveitchik mentioned about his grandfather, he says he was an exception to the rule, and the more he learned and the older he got, the deeper he got. He says he never ceased gaining depth and becoming even more and more abstract. But not everybody could follow him on his level, the level that he was in his old age. But in general, the Talmud says that a person has usually a person's potential is reached in Torah. Torah is a specific field. Science seems to be different. In science, people reach their level at a very early age. In the scientific community, they usually say, finish by 40. If you didn't make your big breakthrough by the age of 40, you're never going to make it. And very few people in science have ever really made breakthroughs even past the age of 30. Most of the breakthroughs of the great minds, like Newton was about 19, 20, 21, Einstein was 24, 25, most of the greats really made their big breakthroughs when they were very young. But not every subject is the same. Torah makes different demands on the human mind than physics does. And in the Torah's system, the Torah's demands on the human mind creates a different kind of a description, and that is that the depth of knowledge increases till approximately 40 years of study. That's the way it works in the Torah subject. I mean, it's a different kind of subject, and it has a different kind of demands on the mind. I guess we're about to turn over the tape. My wife. That is a good point, the point that David mentioned. It could very well be because of the nature of the way the studies are taught in the secular world. I mean, the system of Torah education is far advanced to the system of education that we have in our society. And what David is saying is that the system of Torah permits a person to ever increase his depth beyond the... However, in the world of secular education, the way it's taught is very limiting, and therefore it could very well be that the person ceases to increase the depth after a certain age. That's a possibility. It could be that, or it could be the nature. It's possible that it has to do with the nature of the subject as well. I mean, you know, there are various intellectual disciplines, and each one, makes a different kind of demand. I mean, math and physics, for instance. Mathematics is a certain kind of makes a certain kind of demand on the human intellect, and physics makes a different kind of demand. Einstein was not the greatest mathematician, but he was the greatest physicist. His mind was just perfect for the knowledge of physics. Others were, others are greater in mathematics. I mean, he had various types of, for instance, Galileo and Newton. Galileo was essentially was better in concept. I mean, he really laid the foundation for the concepts of physics. Newton was unbelievable when it came to the mathematics. I mean, he was like one of the most amazing mathematical minds ever. So again, you had a repetition of that with Faraday and Maxwell. Faraday was also was a conceptual man, didn't know much math, but he laid down some of the most fundamental principles in physics today. The whole field concept comes from Faraday. He knew very little mathematics, hardly any. And Maxwell was the mathematician who took the concepts of Faraday and he mathematized them. He was very great in that area. I mean, the human mind has different dimensions and people have different abilities, and each subject makes a different kind of a demand on the person. And Talmud is a subject that is constructed in a certain way that it makes a different kind of a demand. I mean, than mathematics or physics. Okay, maybe one day I'll get into that a little more. But if I did now, I think that would be the end of the lesson. What I'd like to quote again is a quote from Ibn Ezra, and I may have quoted it before, but I will quote it again. I think it's extremely important. And that is, if you want to look it up later, it's in Leviticus 17:7. Okay, and it says that they will not slaughter their sacrifices to the word is se'irim, which means visions of goats or ghosts or whatever, and it says which they are turning after. So the purpose of I mentioned this before, the purpose of the temple was to remove people from their own private fantasy world of sacrificing to these visions that they had. And Ibn Ezra says, because anyone who searches for them or who believes in them is one who turns away from his God. That's why he uses that word. Whenever you use the word zonim, it means to turn away. Zonim achareihem means turning away from God towards these fantasy images. And he says, because the person thinks that someone can do good, someone or something can do good or bad, besides God, the revered and the awesome. Here again, the concept, and this is what happens to these people that think that they are studying Kabbalah, and what they are really doing is indulging in systems which are very primitive and which give powers to other sources besides God. You're inevitably going to find that's the case. I mean, if you just follow them, not too long. I mean, you'll see, like this paper I just read to you before. They have to believe in things having power. That's the primitivism is right there. They must believe that a snake has power, because the primitive need for a physical object that has power is something which is a necessity for them, and it's something other than God that they're looking for, and that is where it leads to. Okay. I want to make sure, just for the record, that you understand that Nachmanides, who maintained that he was a Kabbalist, and he was an authentic Kabbalist, he had the greatest respect for Maimonides, and if you look at his writings, as a matter of fact, there was a time when people criticized Maimonides for his guide, because it is very anti what they think is Kabbalah. It's really anti-primitivism. And Nachmanides, the great Nachmanides, was called upon to give his opinion about this tremendous debate about Maimonides' guide. And he wrote in his letter that those who criticize Maimonides don't even begin to understand what he's saying. And if you take a look at Nachmanides' commentary, he constantly quotes Maimonides from the guide. And never does he say that that Maimonides was, you know, simply was off the track because he was using rational rational thought. He can understand very well, according to these so-called Kabbalists, Maimonides is anathema. I mean, because he simply destroys what they believe in. The basis of, he discloses their primitivism. So if Nachmanides would think that, you understand very well, he would never quote him, let alone praise him. Again, Nachmanides states that whatever Maimonides wrote in the beginning of his code, okay, the one with the 14 sections, the major work of Maimonides, so Nachmanides states that what in the beginning of the code, what Maimonides sets forth is the basic principles concerning God. And Nachmanides says that those words are as if they came from God, he says. That's how the accuracy of those words cannot be contested. That's Nachmanides the Kabbalist, okay? So I want you to understand that all great scholars. Nachmanides, you see, we have a certain, you need certain credentials in order to voice your opinion in halacha. It's like Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say, that unless a person knows Talmud, like Kepler knew the stars, they used to say that Kepler had the stars at his fingertips, he says he has no right to voice his opinion in philosophical matters, and let alone people that can't even decipher a piece of Talmud, I mean, total ignoramuses, you understand very well that these people, their statements can have no value whatsoever. Nachmanides, Maimonides, Rashba, all the great scholars were masters, first and foremost, masters in Talmudic methodology and in the understanding of the Torah with their minds and with their intellects. And the Kabbalah itself, which, again, the Kabbalah itself was an intellectual concept. It was not a primitive idea. Now, I want to mention something that I feel is important, because you may come across it and you may be thrown. And that is that now a lot of things are translated into English. And that's good, but that's bad also. It is not a good idea to translate certain things, because people who aren't ready, again, people who aren't scholars, readily misunderstand. And there are certain things that are mentioned by Nachmanides in his writings on the Bible that we today know are not correct, okay? Biological matters, certain factual things which he mentions in his writings that are not true, they simply are not true. And yet he accepts them as true. Now, I want you to understand something, that this is not, you see, you could look, a person can make a mistake and think, well, there, you see, Nachmanides is a primitive man, he believes these primitive things. I want you to understand that it's very easy to be in our century and to realize that certain things are not true because of the advance of science. But what we fail to do is, it's very difficult for us to project ourselves back into the past and to see how we would reason about certain things that without the knowledge and without the benefit of science. Nachmanides was not a mystical individual. If you look at his interpretation of Torah, you see he's a thoroughly reasoned individual. But certain things that Nachmanides accepted as true, he based completely on the knowledge of the times that the so-called biologists of the times, of his times, laid claim to. And he didn't question them. He simply accepted what they said. Now, he was not a researcher in biology. He was a researcher in Torah. So if you find things that he states that we know today are not true, it is not to these things, the fact that he made a mistake is not to be attributed to any mystical vein in him. On the contrary, he is a completely rational person. But at that time, the rational world accepted that as true. For instance, if I recall, Plato mentions that he believed also in what is referred to in Hebrew as sheidim, which means kind of, you know, type of humanoid type. Modern day replica would be like the abominable snowman type of thing. That these kind of creatures exist in the deserts. Okay, But they thought they really exist there. And many things that are quoted by scholars of not just Talmudic scholars but scholars in general at that time, now to us today, seem ridiculous. It is unfair to say the reason why those people believed in it is because of mysticism. It could be in certain cases, but not always. Many times that was thought to actually exist at that time. Plato believed in those things, and Plato was not a mystic. Plato was a rational philosopher, and many other great thinkers believed in certain things that we know today are not true. You have to realize also that a person who is an honest investigator is many times more gullible than a person who is not. For instance, experiments have been done where scientists were put in a room and magicians were presented to them where they performed certain tricks the scientists couldn't figure them out. The scientists were actually fooled. Now, the reason is very simple. The reason is that nature is not deceitful. Nature is not tricky. Nature is honest. So a scientist isn't ready for trickery. And a magician is. You see, a magician is deceitful. So a magician can fool a scientist because a scientist is very honest and very sincere. And a lot of the things that Nachmanides accepted, he accepted because he believed them. I mean, people came back from India with various tales. He just, you know, he assumed that just like he's honest, they're honest, and he accepted, you know, what they said as being true. Actually those things weren't true, and the people were prevaricators. There is an interesting statement by one of the interpretations on the Mishnah, which talks about the animals of the field, and actually it's a reference to gorillas, but one of the interpreters says that what it means is there's an animal somewhere in the world, and I don't know if he remembered, if he mentioned like it was either Africa or or near China or something. I don't remember exactly where it was, but he said this animal has a its umbilical cord is tied to the ground, and it's extremely powerful, and no man can fight it. But if you cut off its umbilical cord, which is attached to the ground where it gains its nurture from, then it dies. Now, obviously, somebody saw a gorilla, you know, swinging from tree, and they were frightened and ran away. And then they started a story that the vine actually came out of the stomach of the gorilla, and it came back with these kind of stories. Actually, as far as I know, the gorilla, no one really knew what a gorilla was till about 100 years ago. I believe that's the case. But a lot of things, you know, weren't known, and adventurers came back with stories. And many times scholars, because they are so honest, don't think other people, you know, are going to make up lies. And sometimes there's a certain naivete among scientific people. And many times because of that, different facts were accepted as true. But it has nothing to do with Torah. The Torah doesn't discuss these. Doesn't discuss this. It is simply a matter of what was accepted as the science of the time. So this is something which I think you should be aware of. If you see in the words of the scholar certain things which you find as astounding, you have to realize that it's based upon the fact that they weren't really researchers in science. They were researchers in Torah, and they accepted the science of the times. And because of that, some of their facts are inaccurate. But this has nothing to do with Torah, just the fact that everybody is limited by their, by the time in which they live. Okay. I thought that's an important thing because if you come across that, you should realize, again, that that's not because of a mystical trend in the scholar, but rather because of the fact that that was the accepted scientific knowledge of the times. Now, what I'd like to do is, I would like to show you that, I'd like to take a few of the statements of the rabbis, which are indeed mystical sounding at the outset. But I want to show you what the meaning behind it is when you look at it in a rational way, and how enlightening it really is. I'm going to take right now, let me just take a look, I haven't got that much time, I'm going to take the statement of the rabbis found in Sanhedrin. As a matter of fact, it's in the same chapter that we are studying now. And let me just give me 1 second here. The Talmud is found in Sanhedrin 65b. So you could look it up yourself later. Now, the Talmud states as follows, that Rava, he was a foremost scholar, he said that if the righteous wished, they could create the world. Because it says, and there's a statement in Isaiah 59, that says that your sins separated you from me, God says. So they are deriving, they're implying that it means that man would be able to be creative also. And what separates him from being creative is the fact that he sins. Okay, fine. But that's just an introductory interpretation. Now the Talmud states the story. And here's a story, of course, people constantly refer to. It says Rava, this same Rava, who is throughout the Talmud one of the most renowned scholars, it says Rava created a person. Okay? And he sent him before Rabbi Zerah. And Rabbi Zerah was speaking to this person, and the person did not refrain from answering him. So he said to that created person, he says, you are a creation of one of our friends. All right. In other words, you are created by a human being. He says that go back to your earth. All right. Now that's one story. Okay. That's mystical enough. Can't be any more mystical, right? Okay. Another story. Rabbi Hanina and Rabbi Oshia sat every Erev Shabbos, that means every Friday before the Sabbath, and they involved themselves in the book of creation, and they created a fatted calf. Okay? Now, I'm going to stop here. Now the question is, what does this mean? This sounds like, if a person wants to understand this in a mystical way, it sounds like the rabbis simply studied the book of creation, and because of that, they were able to create people and create calves, and do all these kind of weird things. It sounds like a mystical statement. Of course, every one of today's Kabbalists will immediately say, "Oh yes, sure, that's right." As a matter of fact, there's a book out by Arya Kaplan, which on the book of Yetzirah, which proposes to tell you how to do this. Okay, all right. Now, let's try to understand it intelligently, and we'll see that what the Talmud here is teaching us is something that is of great value. All right. The first story says, you'll notice in the first story where it says that Rava created a person. So it says that he spoke, that when he went in front, when this created person went in front of Rabbi Zerah, so Rabbi Zerah spoke to him, but he could not answer him. Okay? So he said that you are from the earth, go back to the earth. Okay? Now, what exactly does that mean? You see, you have to understand that in the time that the Torah was given, there was certain knowledge that was in the Torah and that was hidden in the Torah, so to speak. It wasn't available to everyone, but the scholars were aware of it. They knew about it. And yet it was, see, the Torah has to deal with man and with the universe on a true level, okay? Which means to say that many things won't be discovered for centuries, but yet the Torah has to express ethically what exactly the proper procedure would be with regard to these things, all right? Now, really, what is amazing about this statement is that you see from the Talmud, and by the way, the Kabbalists, the Kabbalistic interpretation does not maintain that that this actually happened either, that it's just a metaphor, okay? But what it means is as follows. What it means is that what the Talmud means is that the scholars of the Talmud knew when they say that man would be able to create, okay, that man would be able to create. What it means is that there is a, they knew that there is a knowledge which would enable a person to produce another living being. Okay, now genetics at that point, genetic engineering at that point was not even in existence. But yet, this truth was known from the philosophical understanding of the Torah. And that philosophical understanding is that since the universe is created through wisdom, and the cells of a human being are based upon God's wisdom, if man would have access to that knowledge, he would be able to create as well. You see? This is precisely what the Talmud is saying. A very remarkable statement, especially from where we stand today. Today we know that is true. Because in the time of the Talmud, people would say, well, that's absurd. It's impossible to produce a living creature, a living being. Now, the Talmud goes so far as to say that man's knowledge can reach, man's biological knowledge can reach a level where you would produce a person. That's basically what the Talmud is saying. And this was something that was known from the Masorah, from the tradition, from Sinai, from interpretation of the Torah itself. Where exactly it is found in the Torah, I cannot say. I mean, this was not, you understand, a lot of these things, most of these things, not a lot, I mean, 99% of this kind of knowledge was lost. We just have fractions of them, and as a matter of fact, if the Talmud had not decided to write down the Talmud, this would have been lost too. But the Ravina Ravashi saw that the knowledge of the Talmud was being lost, so therefore they had it written down. It wasn't supposed to be written down. This was only supposed to be known among scholars. But rather than lose it, they had to compromise and write it down, because you're permitted to violate a law that safeguards Torah if, in the absence of that, you're going to lose the Torah, because then this just doesn't make any sense. It's not logical to keep a safeguard and lose the Torah itself. So the scholars of the Talmud had to write it down. But actually, this was not supposed to be something that the average person should even know about. So, but if you take a look at this remarkable piece of Talmud, and you're an intelligent person, you'll see an amazing thing. You'll see that in the Torah is the knowledge that man will be able to, or can, actually, biologically, engineer a human being, create a human being. That's exactly what Rava was saying. But now look a little further in the story. What does it say? The story says that this person that was created by Rava, he went in front of Rabbi Zera. And Rabbi Zera spoke to him, but he could not answer. What are they trying to tell you by that description, the fact that he spoke to him and he could not answer? What they're trying to tell you is very simple, that the soul of man is something which is given by God. And no matter how advanced man becomes in biology, and no matter how much technological knowledge and biological engineering man becomes capable of, he will never be able to produce a person that is other than the instinctual. You see, in Torah, the mark of wisdom is speech. Speech is always equated with wisdom. Because speech isn't just communication, as some biologists think. Speech, in the Torah's ideas, is the perfecting of thought, perfecting of ideas. Whenever they use speech, speech is the mark of a human being because it's a mark of the intellect. The intellect through speech perfects. Speech is extremely important. In the study of Torah, it's important to speak things out and to learn with others to teach, to learn together with others, because in the speaking process, your thoughts are refined. Speech is the refining of the human thought in the Talmudic principles of education. So what they're saying here is that even if man should advance to the point, it is possible, they're saying if a person has the knowledge, and that's what it means by the righteous, it means he who God has given this knowledge, if a person was truly righteous, it means God would not keep any knowledge from him, a person would be totally knowledgeable, then he would be able to engineer a human being. However, they say this human being would not be able to speak. It would not have any intellect. It would be an instinctual creature operating on an instinctual level. What kind of a thing would it be? Would it be like a monkey? What kind of intelligence would it have? I can't say precisely what the cutoff point is, but there is a cutoff point between the human intellect and the animal intellect, and this creature would only have the animal intellect, nothing more. Okay? Now, the rest of the story says that what did Rabbi Zera say when he spoke? He addressed that humanoid. Had human features, apparently, looked just like a human being, biologically engineered just like a human being, but it lacked the intelligence, which is the soul of man. So it couldn't talk. But then he said to it, he said, go back to the earth. Now, what the Talmud is trying to teach us in this statement is that even if man reaches the level where he can produce another human being physically, okay, And this is something which we cannot do at this point in this stage in history, but we're at a stage where we see such a thing may be possible. The Talmud says it is possible, okay? But the Talmud says man should not do that. That's why it tells you that. In a story form, the Talmud is telling you what you should and what you should not do. In other words, it's telling you what you can do. Is biological engineering possible to the point where a human being can be created in its physical form? The answer of Talmud is yes, can be done. That's what the story is telling us. Will this human being have a soul of man? The answer is no. If science advances to that stage, should we do such a thing? The answer is no, because that's what the Talmud is saying. Rabbi Zera says, you are from earth, go back to your earth, which means to say there is no purpose in such a creation. Okay. Now, I don't know if we have any.
That's a good place to stop.
Good place to stop. Okay.
We're right out of time.
We'll stop there.
Yeah, that's a good point.